BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello, and welcome to the 13th of May edition of Dalek Radio. Coming to you every week on Bristol Community Radio, BCFM 93.2, and on the web from our studios in Queen's Square in Bristol. Today we hear about moves by Home Secretary Jackie Smith to ignore recommendations of her expert panel and reclassify cannabis as a more dangerous Class B drug. Steve Barker from the Legalised Cannabis Alliance explains why he believes making cannabis nearly as dangerous as heroin is actually driven by police arrest targets. Also on the show is the second part of our interview with David Halpin, West Country medical doctor who doesn't believe weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly committed suicide. Well-known TV phone-in and Talksport presenter James Whale got the sack last weekend but bounced straight back with his very own internet radio show to rival Dialect. We hear his latest audio blog. In the wake of the Jersey child abuse scandal and the apparent slow death of the investigation, we hear from one lady, Francesca Brock, from West Sussex, who's done all she can to bring child abuse concerns to the attention to the press without success. We have poetry, a cultural What's On guide, as well as a gig guide, music and song of the week from Jeff Sparks, so hang around. But first, the weekly news roundup with Tony Gosling.
Local train and bus monopoly First Group has been making waves in Scotland. April was a glorious month for Aberdeen-based Worst Group. On the 1st of April, Traffic Commissioner Joan Aitken said she could no longer be lenient on First Scotland East, following the third public inquiry into performance in 3 years. As, quotes, "that has not worked to the degree needed. The heavy fist of regulation must be ungloved," close quotes. Yet the fine she imposed, £132,000, looked more like an April Fool's joke than a punch to make First Group, whose annual turnover is £3.7 billion, mend its ways. On the 3rd of April, First ScotRail's franchise extension was announced. On the 14th of April, First ScotRail announced a 4.9% fare rise in the Strathclyde region, where most of its passengers travel. And on the 16th of April, the Competition Commission signalled above-inflation fare rises for Strathclyde and Edinburgh bus passengers by relaxing the fares cap imposed as a condition of First Group's takeover of Strathclyde buses, a takeover branded as against the public interest by the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. Another year and another anti-terrorism bill is working its way through Parliament. So far, the media coverage has mainly concentrated on the proposed powers to give the police the right to hold suspects for up to 42 days without charge, an increase from the present 28. But the bill, if passed, would also threaten the right of journalists to report or obtain information on the armed forces. This could be applied to journalists investigating corruption in arms procurement, and the relevant clause, 69, contains no public interest defence, only that it's a defence for a person charged with an offence under this section to prove they had reasonable excuse for their action. The bill would also give the police the power to remove any documents, which in practice means any computer or camera, for 96 hours, regardless of whether they may be legally privileged or the subject of journalistic qualified privilege. This represents a direct threat to the confidentiality of sources. Section 64 threatens the right of journalists to report some inquests by providing for them to be held in secret. This would be an additional power to that already in existence, where the public can be banned in cases affecting national security. Objections to the bill, which had its second reading on the 1st of April, have been voiced by journalists and campaigning groups, including Liberty and the Newspaper Society. According to the Press Gazette, the Society has written to Home Secretary Jackie Smith expressing concerns about the bill in the newspaper industry, a move supported also by the Society of Editors. The bill is expected to complete its Commons stage in late May or early June, so there's still time to write to your MP expressing your point of view. The Guardian has expressed its bewilderment over supermarket giant Tesco's decision to continue a legal action for libel and malicious falsehood over accusations of tax avoidance. The paper last weekend apologised for claiming that Tesco had avoided up to £1 billion of corporation tax on property sales through companies based in the Cayman Islands, admitting the figure was instead around £100 million. In a two-page article, a leader and, in its corrections column, the paper also admitted the tax avoided was the 4% stamp duty on land tax and not corporation tax. Guardian bosses had hoped that the articles would end the matter, although it is continuing to prepare its defence to be submitted in 2 weeks. Guardian made the allegations about Tesco in two articles, a leader column and a podcast in February. Saturday's leader made clear that if the supermarket giant felt its reputation had been damaged by the stories, it must explain in some detail why it had gone to such lengths to avoid certain taxes. A spokesman for The Guardian said, "We remain bewildered by Tesco's use of legal action, particularly the damaging claim that our journalism was maliciously dishonest. If Tesco had told us in November what it finally revealed in April, this honest misunderstanding could have been avoided. We hope this might be the end of the matter," he said, "but we will, if necessary, continue to robustly defend the integrity of our journalism and force Tesco to retract its untrue and damaging claims that we deliberately and maliciously lied." A spokesman for Tesco said, "The Guardian Media Group has a serious case to answer, and we look forward to receiving their defence."
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
One of the most frustrating things about Bristol is its drugs problem. Rumours abound that St Paul's is one of the cheapest places in the country to score hard drugs such as heroin and crack cocaine. Most people see such Class A drugs as causing the biggest problems in the city through these drug users' links to violent crime, robbery and burglary. But the Association of Chief Police Officers are making moves in the opposite direction, which has now been adopted by the Home Secretary Jackie Smith. They are focusing on cannabis as the biggest problem and making moves to up cannabis' category from Class C to Class B.
My name is Steve Barker, and I'm a spokesman for the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, and I also run a telephone helpline for people who get arrested for cannabis offences called the Cannabis Legal Support Service. Originally, when cannabis was put into Class C in 2004, the police supported this because it regularised something that was happening irregularly, which was sometimes they let people off who were found in possession of cannabis, sometimes they'd arrest them, sometimes they'd give them a caution. There was no straight-through policy. This was to standardise that policy, and in the original guidelines, the police, the ACPO guidelines, they said that personal possession of cannabis would no longer be an arrestable offence, although in actual practice, most people who are found by police to be in possession of cannabis are given a caution. But a caution itself is no longer counts as an offence, so it would not count against your employment record, for example.
What other implications are there if it goes to Class B, say, for example, for people who are dealing in cannabis or growing cannabis?
Well, when they move cannabis into Class C, they up the penalties for Class C production and supply to what they were under Class B. So in a report put out by the Institute of Criminal Policy Research on policing cannabis in Class C basically said nothing very much had changed. Now, the reason that is given by the police and the people who are talking about putting it back into Class B is that they think that a lot of kids are using cannabis under the impression that it's legal. What they're not considering is that the government's own figures have shown that the use of cannabis, since it was put into Class C, has gone down by 25%. Now, in most businesses, this would be considered to be a considerable success. What we're saying is that some kids were actually taking cannabis because it was illegal, and we would predict that if they put it back into Class C, use amongst young people is going to go up because they see it as a blow against the empire. some people say that the police are actually chasing arrest targets and conviction targets. And if they recriminalise cannabis, this means they get better figures.
So what you're saying is the more things that the police can criminalise, the better their figures at the end of the year, the more arrests, and they're getting these kind of targets up.
I don't blame the police for this, but this is a way that policing is going. They're not actually looking at solving social problems. They are actually looking at getting figures up. So what this means is that not just cannabis, but all drugs convictions, they become like currency within the criminal justice industry. And, of course, a lot of people make money out of drug convictions, the solicitors, the police, the private prison industry.
There is another side to all this, of course, and that is one of the most controversial things here in Bristol, in the inner city, is that there are parts of the inner city where there is hard drug dealing going on of heroin and crack cocaine. And many people drive past these places day after day and they see deals going on in the street, and yet the police don't act. Now, the reason for that, the police tell us, is that they want to keep paid informers to be informing the police on these places rather than closing them down.
There was a lady, an elderly lady in the north of England who was arrested, a medical cannabis user, who actually went into the police station, spoke to a senior police officer and says, why are you paying money to hard drug dealers to report medical cannabis users and allowing them continue to operate? And the police officer said, cannabis dealers don't give us the information we want. This is followed up by another letter from a representative of the Legalised Cannabis Alliance to Vic Hogg, who is a senior representative of the Home Office, who looked into this, and he came back and said, the police said that this is procedure. This is policy.
So it's actual policy because the police aren't getting, what they say, is enough information from cannabis users about who's using drugs and who's dealing drugs, that they're actually keeping these illegal crack dens and heroin dealing areas open in order to get information. But what about the ethics of that?
Well, there's a case of two brothers who were brought into the country, I can't remember their names offhand, from Turkey, on the basis of the fact that they were supposed to be giving information to the intelligence services who are responsible for monitoring drug importation. They were brought into the country. They wound up being the biggest hard drug dealers and biggest heroin dealers in the country. They're both now in prison, one in Holland and one in this country. So this was done with government money. The situation is that the police are actually being drawn into turf wars. There's no doubt about this at all. The smart dealers who know who to pay off in the police and how to get bent results are actually operating with impunity and in exchange for selling the names and addresses of their clients to the police.
But if they're selling the names and addresses of their clients to the police, surely those clients are going to be being arrested and they're knocking down their client base. You know, it seems very strange to allow a dealer to continue to operate just so long as he supplies you names and addresses, because he's going to surely eventually run out of people to be selling drugs to.
Well, you're now talking about demand and supply and market forces within the illegal drug world. I wouldn't like to comment on their marketing policy, but they obviously take that into account.
Is there any way you think that local people can campaign for hard drug dens to be closed down whilst the police are still paying informers to sort of keep an information flow going?
Well, there's a lot of people involved in the campaign to legalise cannabis who are former hard drug users who have found that use of cannabis has actually helped them to stay off hard drugs, stay off alcohol, and in some cases give up tobacco smoking. So the issue is, what are the effects of social cannabis use? Well, cannabis users, on the whole, are non-violent. Cannabis is not addictive, and it doesn't have any serious health problems. When you consider there are different ways you can take cannabis, you can take it in food, you can smoke it through a sort of inhaler that turns it into vapor. You can smoke it through a bong that takes out some of the toxics, water. Smoker. There's various different ways you can take cannabis, and most cannabis users are recreational ones. There's a lot of people in the country who use cannabis for medical reasons. They suffer depression or they suffer physical pain, and they are using it to reduce the symptoms of those things. So actually, cannabis use is actually saving the government and the health service money. But, of course, we're not getting this argument through.
Steve Barker there, spokesman for the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, who run a drugs helpline, talking to Dalek's Tony Gosling about proposals from the Association of Chief Police Officers, now taken up by Home Secretary Jackie Smith, to upgrade cannabis from a Class C drug to a Class B. Steve was also giving us an insight into how the police's use of paid informers keeps crack and heroin dealers in business. Now time for some Irish music from a CD called Irish Music from the Rough Guide collection. This is Martin Murray, and this is the track Sod of Turf / Katie Goes to Granny. That was Sod of Turf / Katie Goes to Granny by Martin Murray from the CD Irish Music from the Rough Guide collection.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
West Country doctor David Halpin did everything he could to stop the invasion of Iraq. He went public with his professional opinion that the government scientist David Kelly had been murdered and didn't commit suicide. He's adamant that David Kelly was executed on the eve of the Iraq invasion as part of a war crimes cover-up. In the second of this two-part interview, Dalek's Tony Gosling asked him what his qualifications were to speak on matters medical.
Well, I qualified in 1964, MBBS, from St Mary's Hospital, as a London degree, and about 9 years later, 75, I became a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons. And I was a trauma and orthopaedic surgeon for, what, 3 or 4 years before, and then since, until I retired early. And,
So from the point of view of a medical doctor, other than this idea that from one artery being severed, that he really shouldn't have been able to bleed to death, what are the other really medical reasons why you think what happened to Kelly is more likely to have been someone else intervening rather than suicide?
I think it's preposterous that this man, that one can consider this particular man, this man in particular, would have taken his life in his way. That's a very, very important point. I don't think it comes out at all in the Hutton Inquiry, actually. No surprise there. But there's a lot about it. You know, we as doctors, there was an anaesthetist in our group from South Africa, an academic. You know, he was a fellow who taught as well. He wasn't a professor. Senate, Cyril Senate. And he went, he read 40 papers on the estimation of opiates, heroin and morphine-like drugs in the blood. And he discovered there was a papers from a man called Pounder, Derek Pounder, up in the forensic science professor up in Dundee. And two of those papers, the author was in fact a Japanese, I think, but they showed that it was critical where you took the blood from. That if you took it from the periphery, from the, you know, say the hands, or towards the hands and towards the feet, that it would be a lower reading than if you took it from the major vessels in the post-mortem, say in the vena cava. That's one thing. And the other thing, too, that came out was that the concentration of opiate increased with time after death and went on increasing. I can't remember the figures exactly, but there were critical things there. None of that was exposed.
So you're saying that...
We don't even know what blood tests were taken. The records of the chemistry, we didn't see the post-mortem report. We've seen no autopsy report. That perhaps might... I think Baker tried to get hold of that, I think, Norma Baker. But there were quite a lot of chemical tests that were withheld by the Thames Valley Police. Chief Constable, a man called Page, he's received, I think this is in Norman Baker's book, he's received an honour from the Americans, the only policeman known to have received an honour in this country from the United States of America.
Certainly it looks suspicious. Do you think the truth will ever come out about Kelly? Is this maybe you feel it's already dribbling out, coming out, and you know, the public are sceptical enough about it?
No, I think the public are sceptical. A lot of people, I think you ask, I think they've done polls. BBC did a poll before their Dan programme. About, I don't know, 40% or 30% were sceptical about the verdict. But if you ask my types, you know, doctors, surgeons, about it, most of the people I come across shrug a little. I'm generalising there. And say, oh, he's bumped off. What disturbs me is they say it with a slight grin. I find that. I can't understand it. I abhor it. I abhor untruth. And I abhor the fact that someone might have been assassinated because he didn't suit. You know, because he could have said something or whatever. I don't know, we thought about that. We also don't know, for instance, why his widow's kept quiet. We talked about that. How can you do that if he was assassinated? But as for it coming out, well, there's Norman Baker's book, which I understand has added quite a few things. I must read it still. He quotes me once or twice in it. Not that it matters. We've heard a little bit more. We've heard a bit more about my colleague of mine who's working on it still. Is very keen on the Judith Miller plane connection in the States, you know, the CIA lady who was outed by her husband, Wilson, who was who was at the bottom of finding out that the Niger yellow cake thing was nonsense. And to get back at him, Libby, I think it was Scooter Libby, I think it was. It's so complicated. It's sort of like rubbish, isn't it, really? But of course, there's people's lives at the bottom of it, like our Iraqi brothers and sisters. She was outed playing when she was a CIA operative, and of course that's something which is verboten, or was meant to be, and I think Miller was involved in that.
But so what was her connection with Kelly?
Well, she corresponded with Kelly Miller. She was the Ziocon mouthpiece in the Washington Post, I think that's right, and So he was one, and he also crossed one over. There's another American called May Peterson, who was, I think, CIA operative actually. But what they were, what Stephen thinks might have been happening is they might have been up to planting WMD in Iraq, and that Kelly got wind of that. That's what that's his theory. Now it may we've been hoping all the time for a whistleblower to emerge, because we've tried jolly hard. I've spent Stephen and other people, Stephen and myself particularly, have spent thousands of hours on this. I can't tell you how many emails. It's a very detailed, it's a very complex study. It wouldn't have been complex if there was an inquest done properly and, well, done truthfully. And it hasn't been like that, as you'd expect. And that's the other reason, of course, why you suspect that it wasn't a suicide, is that the method they chose. Do you know that Hutton was appointed within 24 hours of Kelly's death? Do you know that? A phone call from Fatty Arbuckle, what's his name, Lord, he was in the chambers with Blair. He was Lord Chancellor at the time.
Could you just give us a quick roundup of your doctor's group? You know, who are they, and what did they bring to this doctor's group who have been so critical of the way that the Kelly death has been spun?
Well, I can't remember them all, but one was a pathologist. There's no secrets here because we all had our name in the Guardian. Andrew Russ, he and a very excellent junior. Or senior junior, a Syrian as it happens, a very brave chap. They looked into literature and they found that death by slashing was extremely rare. They found, came across a paper from Pennsylvania Penitentiary or something, a ghastly, most frightening paper. Another thing they found as well, from our own statistics of death in this country. So it was Rouse, there was a general physician, my good friend Burns Cox, who comes to Gaza with me sometimes. Just come back from then. There was Searle Sennett, an anaesthetist. There was John Skerr, a vascular surgeon. There was a fellow called Peter Fletcher, who had studied pathology, medical pathology, but he wasn't, I don't think, a medical doctor. I think he was he went to pathology via chemical pathology, but he had very interesting things to say about it. In fact, he was pretty certain that it wasn't Kelly that they buried. Another matter. And there were about four or five other doctors, or another nice man, Martin Bernstingle, who was a general surgeon at the Barts Hospital, very prominent chap, and also he was a vascular surgeon later on. So he knew all about vessels being cut, as did John Skerr, as did I. Do you see what I mean? I can't think of the other four at the moment. My brain is getting tired.
So, if Kelly didn't commit suicide, who killed him?
Well, we are not going to speculate about that now, particularly as I live. When I first started looking into this, I used to look in a rearview mirror occasionally on the dual carriageway. But I've got my thoughts about it. And the one thing I found pretty daft about Norman Baker's book. But as someone said to me since then, you know, that Norman probably has some respect for his own neck. He's talked about the Iraqis doing it, Chalabi, particularly expatriate. Apparently, Chalabi has a sort of mentality which would not be beyond that. But I think it's just so unlikely as a motive.
Controversial West Country doctor David Halpin there, talking about the death of Dr. David Kelly in the final part of his interview with Dalek's Tony Gosling.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
For the last 30 years or so, radio talk show host James Whale has been heard on British airwaves. From humble beginnings on Radio Air in Yorkshire back in the 1980s, Whale became one of the most listened to talk show hosts in the country on TalkSport Radio on Medium Wave. Last week, he was given his cards by TalkSport bosses, who said it was because he supported Boris Johnson as London Mayor. Many people, though, believe that this is an attack on free speech, that he was really sacked for his outspoken views on 9/11 and global warming, both of which he believed were being used in their different ways to manipulate public opinion. Anyway, James has started a nightly internet radio blog, which is free to share on the internet. And here's what it sounds like.
Hi, Whaley's on. Aha, the bad boy of British radio. I see I am in the newspapers. It's getting bigger and bigger, isn't it? I can't believe it. I can't believe the words that slip from my mouth can have caused quite so much fuss. They never seem to have before. But never mind. Here we are, JamesWhaleRadio.com. Welcome to my nightly blog, and hopefully soon coming to you live. Now, today, I can't believe, first of all, the amount of money we're going to spend on the Olympics. 9.3 million and rising? Where the hell is this money coming from? Are you and I going to be in debt now for the rest of our natural lives and our children too? Maybe I missed something here. Maybe I'm out of step. Maybe it is the majority of people who really like the idea of the Olympic Games. I'm not sure. Perhaps you'll tell me. Don't forget, you can call us on 0871-0500818. That's 0871-0500818 on JamesWhaleRadio.com, and leave your messages. And thank you for them as well, some of which you'll be able to hear here. Mrs. Whale's diary, I see, was getting a little bit irate today. She's quite glad to have me at home, I have to tell you, but I think that will probably wear thin in a few months. You never know. You never know. And I noticed that my former boss, Mr. McKenzie, was having a go in his column today. That was very kind of him. But listen, the real problem today, again, they're lying to us. Jackie Smith clinging on to her her job. I can't, you know, she's got great breasts, but come on, guys. I mean, is she really a fit and proper person to be the Home Secretary? I mean, look at her. She's about as awe-inspiring as a slug. I mean, she doesn't even dress properly. You know, you've got to have people who have some kind of some charisma. How can you really expect to keep the public interested if you stand up like a great big large lump of lard? So she's going to control job culture, is she? Well, they haven't controlled job culture for the last 10 years, since it's been aggravating all of us. So what Jackie Smith's going to do, I have no idea. I suppose we're going to get the community support officers going up to the scummy yobbos and telling them to stop it. I don't think it's going to work, do you? I sincerely don't think it's going to work. They're going to get the police more involved in sorting the people standing on the street corners out. The police aren't interested. They haven't got time. And what are the courts going to do? They're all under 18? It's absolutely stupid. Still, it's been a very nice sunny day, and I hope you've been making the most of it. I've had a barbecue. A nice barbecue, a couple of chicken breasts on there, a glass of white wine, sitting out lunchtime, feeling very decadent. Although, I suppose the money's going to run out fairly soon. I'm going to have to try and find some sort of work. As you can see, I've got a few offers in. I've got a few jobs coming up, and hopefully I'm going to find some sponsors for JamesWhaleRadio.com fairly soon so that we can go live on the air. I have an interesting thing to tell you that I'm going to start doing, but I'm not going to tell you until next week when it will become public. But I will hopefully have a forum where you can phone and have a chat with me once a week, starting week after next, but I'll tell you more about that next week. Good to hear from you. Thank you so much for the emails as well that have been coming in. I do get to see them. Please keep sending them in and tell your friends. Come on to the site. Get involved, and if you have a site, well, create links to us. That will be amazing. And tell me what you think of what's going on. The JamesWhaleRadio.com site, available to you. Get involved. Click on. Create an account. Do your stuff. And give us a ring and leave your voice messages. I want to hear what you have to say, and we will play some of them on the site. Call me now. 0871-0500818. Okay, I'm going to go off and have a bit of fun this evening. I hope you do the same. Join me again tomorrow night on JamesWhaleRadio.com. Love you. See you soon.
Radio talk show host James Whale there, confined to the internet for now, but still his outspoken self. And as James said, you can hear him every night on www.JamesWhaleRadio.com. This is a song by Martin Noakes called 9/11 Building 7.
Open. won't melt steel. It's not hot enough. It's nothing new, it's not a mystery. Check out the Reichstag, Germany. There's a million questions still remain unanswered. There's a million questions still to be resolved. Out of 19 Muslim guys, 7 still remain alive. It's nothing new, it's not a mystery. Check out the USS Liberty. 9/11, 9/11, what went down with Building 7? It's a mystery to this day. The building fell with such precision, free fall speed, no reasons given, like the towers it just fell. The fire's not enough, no way hot enough to bring it down. The project for the new American century was added to a year before that day. It states in order to proceed, a modern day Pearl Harbor. Set them free, the project for the new American century.
That was 9/11 Building 7 by Martin Noakes.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Despite the discovery of links to the Islington child abuse scandal and discovery of child's remains under the ex-children's home at Haute de la Garenne, the Jersey child abuse scandal has disappeared from the headlines over the past few weeks. Dialect has come across one lady, Francesca Brock from West Sussex, who throws light on why that might be. She has found the press reluctant to cover such sensitive stories, despite having done all she can to bring child abuse concerns to the attention of the press. This is worrying only because it leaves the police able to effectively veto any child abuse investigation.
The point I wanted to make was I had, up until a couple of years ago, the simple belief that the press was there to let the public know various important facts, and then it would peter off to the trivia of colours of handbags and entertainment. And from my own experience, this is not the case. I was in the position of taking my disabled son away from a special school he was in. I had an Ofsted report done at my request that showed children at night could be accessed by anyone walking into their rooms. And it was decided that wouldn't be shown to any parents. Now, I took it to newspapers and media across the country for 2 years, and I'm fairly persistent, and nobody wanted to know. Because I think it would have stirred up too much trouble. I think, for a start, the establishment in question was the only one available. It was run by, it's a heavy Masonic kind of a place. Which I know sounds a bit paranoid, but what would you conclude if this happened in a mainstream school? It would be all over the Sun, and we would be interviewing and finding out what the mothers had for breakfast.
Francesca Brock there blamed the press for avoiding child abuse stories. Two people have been charged in the Jersey case, but none so far on the charges of murder or false imprisonment at the former children's home. It's now time for some poetry, and we're going to go over to my co-presenter Lisa Braden with a personal poem, the title of which we can't actually broadcast on the air, but the topic of it is a sensitive personal issue that occurred late last year.
Thank you, John. If I had a gun, I'd shoot your head. A knife, I'd stab you until you're dead. To you, I was opportunistic, easy meat, discarded like litter, alone on the street. Your objective was simple, to violate, a drunken docile for you to humiliate. Ha ha, I'm the police's April Fool, sexual quarry then mugged, how cruel. I'm a time waster, deranged, a liar, a whore. It's a man's world and I know the score. Dirty, soiled, not unlike my clothes, lame Lisa, a tarnished gold rose. You left me cold like thick set honey, a double bubble, sex and my money. Coatless, phoneless, my December nadir, suffering alone in imposed perdition of fear. You prospered and fed, put it all on my bill. What size are you? Must be big boots to fill. I despise you, I hate you, I seethe from my spine. Watch out, big boy, revenge will be mine.
Thank you, Lisa. Just leave a sort of moment's pause whilst our What's On guide, Jeff Sparks, takes the seat, and he also has some poetry that he would like to share with us today. What's the title of your piece?
Well, there's no real title to it, but I wrote this while I was in the Goddess Temple in Glastonbury on 15th of February last year. Here I am in the temple to the Goddess, incense drifting through the air. Such a peaceful place, I must confess. I feel such a place like this is rare. Mind relaxes as my thoughts drift off in a dream, through forests, over hills and across a stream. My breath rises and it falls as I hear the Goddess call. I must soon go back to the hectic society. I know this place will always be here, a special place to always be free, a place in my heart to feel no fear.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, time for an exclusive. We've got a new feature now on Dialect Radio. It's our Culture Vulture Hotspot, done by Lisa Braden.
Thank you, John. Welcome to a new spot on the show, the Culture Vulture Supplement. I'll be perusing what's on at the theatre, what exhibitions are on, and what poetry venues are up for grabs. Primarily, I cannot praise enough the superb performance of Alfie Allen, brother of Lily, and Simon Callow. Their rendition of Equus at the Theatre Royal in Bath was outstanding. Sadly, the run finishes tomorrow, but fear not, fabulously entertaining theatre can still be devoured from the 12th of May in the form of the 39 Steps. This comedy thriller of John Buchan's epic yarn is on at the Theatre Royal until Saturday the 17th of May. For more information, go to www.theatreroyal.org.uk. Back in Bristol, the Alma Tavern is staging Tiny Dynamite tomorrow evening at 8pm. The play is about an ex-junkie, Anthony, who holidays every year with his friend Lucian, and their encounter with a lady called Madeline, who changes their lives forever. For more information on this play, contact the Alma directly on 0117 9467 899. Tomorrow night at the Tobacco Factory, Instant Whip are performing their quick-fire improvisation comedy, a bit like Whose Line Is It Anyway. It all kicks off at 8pm. If you'd like to know more information about this, contact the factory on 0117 902 0344. Art-wise, there's an exhibition on at the Arnolfini until the 15th of June. Roll Control is by artist Saskia Homswit. This video installation explores notions of credibility and social strategy. If this whets your appetite, contact the Arnolfini on 0117 917 2300. Finally, Bristol Hippodrome has Beauty and the Beast on ice until the 11th of June. The Russian Ice Stars present their version of the classic fairy tale. For further details, go to www.bristolhippodrome.co.uk. That's all for this week. If there's a venue you'd like to promote, then contact me, Lisa Braden, via the Dialect website, www.dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks for listening. I look forward to telling you more of What's On Culturally next week.
Thank you, Lisa. It's now time for the What's On Guide with Jeff Sparks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio, starting with Friday, 16th of May, at the Trinity Centre in Bristol. The psychedelic hard rock group Black Mountain will be performing. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £10 each. On the same night, and this time at the Fleece in Bristol, the Clash tribute group London Calling will be performing with support from the Bolsheviks. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £7 in advance. And finally, on the 16th of May, at the Subscription Rooms in Stroud, the legendary blues rock group Dr. Feelgood are performing. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £15 each. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I feature the influential and simply one of the best groups around, John Mayall and the Bluesbreakers. From 1963 right up to present day, this group featured many musicians, for example Eric Clapton, Peter Green and Mick Fleetwood. This track was originally co-written by Freddie King and Sonny Thompson, and is titled Driving Sideways, and is from the album Crusade, which was released in 1967. We'll be right back. That was John Mayall and the Blues Breakers with Driving Sideways from the album Crusade. Worth noting is the lead guitarist in the lineup was Mick Taylor, who joined the Rolling Stones in 1969. For more information, you can check out www.johnmayall.com. Moving on to Saturday 17th of May and at the Thunderbolt on Bath Road in Bristol, another legendary blues rock group will be performing, namely Eddie and the Hot Rods. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 5 p.m. Keeping with 17th of May and at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road in Bristol, Rick Payne and the Blues Cowboys will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Finally, on 17th of May and at Area 81, which is next to the Packhorse Pub in Lawrence Hill, Van Rensburg will be performing with support from the Trick Babies and Alien Stash Tin. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door and £5 after 10 p.m. And now we come to Sunday 18th of May, and at the Mud Dock, which is near to Thecla in Bristol, Emma Hutchinson will be performing a mix of originals and covers. The gig should start around 3 p.m. and entry is free. That's all from me. Have a great week and thank you for listening. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. I think we've hopefully got time to squeeze one more song in, so this is 10 Second Freefall by a Texas band called Three Shoes Posse.
We know the official story is impossible, so we set about scientifically to come up with a hypothesis and then to test that.
All right, we're just searching for the truth, because so far we've been truthless. Don't mean to be ruthless.
I do.
It was a 10-second free fall. That's what I saw, that's what you saw, that's what everybody saw. 10-second free fall. Official story don't make a lick of sense at all. It was a 10-second free fall.
Clearly the buildings are brought down by controlled demolition.
It was controlled demolition. Concrete into fine dust. That's a hell of a transition from controlled demolition. They believe in fairy tales and the 911 commission, but not controlled demolition.
Well, I would just ignore that idiot.
Ashes to ashes, concrete to dust. Twin tower fall down in front of us. The beam them use in the building, you see. Twin tower should have stand up and not take it easily. Man, Mr. Julian, no man, him in Hawaii. How you beam them, destroy them quickly. Building seven, man, them done destroy. Destroy the paper, them a lot quickly.
I ain't no rocket scientist.
I am.
But I got two good eyes and I can see right through your tricks. I ain't no rocket scientist. You can't change the laws of nature. You can't change the laws of physics. I don't need to be a rocket scientist.
Professor Stephen Jones, he has a doctorate in physics, and he has now gotten samples. They've taken the samples. They've done scientific tests on them. Professor Jones just doesn't find evidence of thermite. They find the byproducts of thermate, patented for specific use in cutting steel columns. The hair on the back of my neck standing up.
10-second free fall. That's what everybody saw. 10-second free fall. Feels like my best friend just sucker punched me upside my jaw with a 10-second free fall.
The groundbreaking test. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I was rather surprised when we did the analysis was the amount of sulfur. And sulfur added to thermite, it's called thermate, and that is used specifically to cut through steel. I mean, when you put sulfur in thermite, whammo, that's like a hot knife through butter.
Control demolition. Most of the world with a few well-placed munitions.
Police saying bombs are going
demolition,
on.
All because one world government wants to come to its fruition. They did control demolition.
6.5 seconds, collapse the building 7.
Search on building 7. And it might turn out that it's your own neck that you are saving. Do a search on building 7. It might turn out that it's your republic that you're saving. Search on building 7.
We looked at the free fall compared to the fall of building 7, and they're almost the same. When I saw the collapse of building 7, man, I said to myself, that is strange. I'd never seen it before. You know, collapse that late afternoon. It was never hit by a jet, but here it comes straight down. I don't see any raging inferno in this building, but I do see it fall straight down.
Man, they killing me, say, when me see NBC, ABC, and CBS. Lord, them I tell a whole heap of lies to we, them not tell the truth. Man, them crazy, who want an investigation about it. Lord, them blow it up in front of we. Ashes to ashes, concrete to dust. Twin tower fall down in front of us.
A real investigation.
Pool for molten metal.
That's what we need, so we can take back our nation. Real investigation. I saw a 10-second freak fall, so I want you all to call out for a real investigation.
If you've ever had a wood-burning stove, but you've never had that puppy melt on you, I dare say.
That's what everybody saw. 10-second free fall. Official story don't make a lick of sense at all. It was a 10-second free fall.
The implications stop many people from going past square one. I mean, they say, well, wait a minute, you know, are we talking about an inside job here? And I'm saying, well, I'm talking about physics. And they say, but that would imply an inside job. I say, I'm afraid so. You know, explosives in a building, it takes time to plan and plant those explosives and incendiaries. I'm afraid that the truth is out. The fact, you know, to suggest that Arabs had access in these buildings, particularly Building 7, which housed the secret CIA office, is ridiculous in the extreme.
9/11 is an inside job. You know, how they claim they fell was a lie, and the official story is completely unscientific and a fraud and a lie. They have Silverstein slipping up and saying he pulled it. Everybody was there.
That's right. Oh, I mean, I know. This is a very secure building. There's security. Who was it in charge of security at the towers? I mean, he would be offended, too.
That was 10-second Free Fall by Texas band Three Shoes Posse. Well, that's it for this week's show. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on the web at www.dialectradio.co.uk and on BCFM 93.2 in the Bristol area. The show is run by the Bristol Broadband Co-op and anyone can contribute, and that means you. So if you'd like to, either in reporting, production support or on the engineering side, do please get in touch by calling Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. The reporters this week were Tony Gosling, and the arts features were from Lisa Braden and Jess Sparks. Thank you to Jess Sparks for the What's On Guide also, and studio production was by Village Chitrakuran. The presenter was John Peters Coleman, and the producer was Tony Gosling. So this is Dalek Radio wishing you a very good night, and until next week then, from the Dalek team and our Queen's Jazz studios in Bristol, thank you for joining us.